We're going to go ahead and start on that.
From the last talk, maybe a little bit broader perspective. I got to say, first of all, that I feel a little bit silly speaking from up here on the stage. What I have to say is not so important that I feel I have to pontificate from a higher level than you. And especially after the worship service this morning, I feel especially silly doing that. As passionate as I am about math and random systems, I don't think this is going to be quite as moving as Amazing Grace. But I may be wrong. Okay, so I was going to originally subtitle or title this talk Some Random Thoughts on Randomness Randomly Presented. And I think that's still going to be a suitable subtitle, you'll see by the end. But I think it gave me a better sense of the context of what I have to say when I saw the screening of the movie From the Dust last night. And the story, especially of Richard Colling, who wrote Random Designer, and the controversy and discussion that was engendered by that book. And if anything, the things that I'm going to have to say today speak to that general topic about whether it's possible to use randomness in a constructive fashion. Is that possibly one of the mechanisms that God has used in, let's say, in evolution, but not necessarily. There are other examples. But let me use this one specifically. So just a general one perspective, one sense of the problem. Evolution via natural selection is based on random mutations. That's one of the mechanisms, one of the parts of how it works. So how can we be the end result of a master plan, a purposive evolutionary plan, if we're the product of random chance? Not a bad question. I'm certainly not the first one to ask that. So here are here's some broader perspective before I get into some specific things. So first of all, sometimes what looks like a random system, of course, is not really random. A very popular example in the last 20, 30 years is that of chaotic systems. Chaotic systems are deterministic systems. They can be described by deterministic equations, but for all practical purposes, they are unpredictable. So you can consider them random, but they're not truly random in the mathematical sense. The weather is a paradigmatic example. There's just no way that you can know enough about the initial conditions. There's no way you can measure enough pieces of data, enough initial conditions to establish a state vector with enough precision that you can then feed it into the equations of the dynamical equations and follow that for any reasonable, useful length of time. You just The uncertainties in the initial conditions come up very quickly and random. In fact, it's chaotic. Sometimes it's a lack of understanding. So I have the name Kalman on there. I don't know how many people here are familiar with a very popular technique in signal processing called Kalman filter. Thank you. At least one. So it is very well established. It's what helped us navigate to the moon, among many other things. And Kalman himself came and gave a talk while I was in graduate school about 25 years ago. And this is a statistical technique. This is a way to propagate statistical knowledge of a system, including what you know about the source of the random errors, propagate it forward and maintain a good idea of how the uncertainty in your estimates as you go forward and how you can reduce that uncertainty with measurements. And the point of Kalman's talk that day was that a lot of this randomness, this random process formulation of these kinds of things is all baloney. It's just the fact that if we only had more information about the system, we wouldn't need all of this stuff. And here's one of the people who really developed this to a high art. And there are people in the audience who were very upset about this because they had devoted their careers and their upcoming graduate careers to understanding Kalman filters, which are not trivial. So there's always the possibility that what we're looking at that to us may appear random maybe really isn't random. Another aspect of that is that I will get to in a little bit of detail. Randomness is not intuitive, so it's hard to even recognize when a system is random. So that feeds into the whole thing. We should note that, though, however, that As far as we can determine by the best statistical tests that are out there, there really are some things that are random. Timing of radioactive decay is one example. Now, I have the word hot bits there in parentheses. If you need to do randomization of a computer algorithm, computer random number generators are pretty good. They're getting better all the time, but they're deterministic equations. So they're not really random. They're pseudo-random. If you really need to get random numbers, go to a website called Hot Bits, and they derive random numbers from the timing of radioactive decay as requested. In other words, they don't take a bunch of them and put them on a website for you to get, because when the second person gets them, they're not random anymore. You tell them how many you need, and they generate them for you, and then you take them. And they meet just about every test of randomness that has been devised. So there apparently really are some random systems out there. So let me extend these ideas a little bit more. We appreciate the beauty and elegance of physical laws. I think most of us here from a scientific background would agree with that. And also very many mathematical laws, at least deterministic mathematical laws, which offer powerful explanations of physics and biology and demonstrate underlying order. If there's any reason to, one compelling reason perhaps to believe in a God is that things are so organized and can be explained by mathematics. And mathematical explanations of physical processes predict new physical processes and new physical phenomena, which then turn out to be true. We have no right to expect that, no right to be granted that gift. But let's extend that. There are rules governing randomness as well, and these are beautiful and orderly as well. And I think some appreciation of those may help break down some of the apprehension and maybe fear or mistrust that some people may express when confronted with a random system and randomness working in biology and possibly evolution. So Stephen Jay Gould, for example, says, misunderstanding of probability may be the greatest of all impediments to scientific literacy. Francis Galton, I know of scarcely anything so apt to impress the imagination as the wonderful form of cosmic order expressed by the law of frequency of error. He's talking about the derivation of the normal distribution, the Gaussian distribution, which you see up there. It reigns with serenity and complete self-effacement amidst the wildest confusion. The larger the mob, the greater the apparent anarchy, the more perfect is its sway. It is the supreme law of unreason. So what's he saying? Well, a lot of things follow the normal distribution that you see up there, distribution of weights, distribution of heights in a population, distribution of IQ, very large number of things. And the really impressive thing about this is that the more people you get, the larger your sample is, the better it fits the law. That's a little bit counterintuitive at first. This must have been a remarkable finding at the time, that there's a mathematical law that can really explain this, and it works better and better as you would get more data. You expect it might break down the more data you get, because now you're getting data that may be off the curve. In fact, it's just the opposite. Now, I did mention human height distribution, human weight distribution. Obviously, the weight distribution now may have a longer tail on the right-hand side. Nevertheless, these things do change. Okay, randomness is not intuitive. If you ask humans to generate random numbers or random locations along a line, for example, they're really bad at it. They tend to alternate. If there's a high number, they tend to give a low number. If there's a low number, they tend to give a high. They very infrequently will follow a sequence of increasing magnitude or decreasing magnitude, but that's what you get from a random selection sometimes. It's perfectly normal. And there's a tendency to neglect the extreme values, to not sample on the tails of the distribution. Now, fortunately, if you need this sort of thing, there are random number generators in computers. If you're really old-fashioned, you go to this great book called A Million Random Digits, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a book published by the RAND Corporation many decades ago that is just random digits. I don't have that in my library yet, but I'm looking forward to reading it right after I read the phone book. Okay, another example, randomness is not intuitive. Look at the top two graphs, the one on the left, the one on the right. Which one's random? without looking at the ones on the bottom. Okay? They both look kind of equally haphazard. This is just an index value along the x-axis and a magnitude along the y-axis, so over here and over here. And you might be able to pick up some structure in each one of them, sequences of values increasing or decreasing, but the key behind those is that the one on the right is generated by this law that you see at the bottom. This is value at time index I, and this is value at time index I plus 1. In other words, if this is the value now, then boom, you go up in the graph. This is the value on the next iteration. And then you plug this one back down here, and you iterate that equation. It's the logistic equation. It produces, for some values, it produces a chaotic sequence, which is probably what this is. Whereas this is the one-ahead map that takes you from x sub I to x sub I plus 1. And this really is random, or at least haphazard. And yet, you wouldn't know it by looking at those. So we're really very bad judges of randomness. Now, there's an industry that takes advantage of this non-intuitive nature of randomness. The gambler's fallacy, for example. You're flipping a coin. You get a sequence of heads, all heads, 10 heads in a row. What's the next one that's going to come up? What do you guess? Well, if it's a fair coin, obviously, we all know, at least we know cognitively, mentally, that the next one is just as equally likely to come up heads or tails. But if you're sitting in a casino and you get a sequence like that, it's really hard to convince yourself that the next one has got to be a tail. It's due to come up. And there's, like I said, there's a whole industry built on this misunderstanding. As a matter of fact, they even like to help you by, over here on the roulette table, posting the sequence of past numbers. So you can look at that and stare at that and try to detect the pattern. Yes, there's a name for people who go into casinos with a foolproof system. They're called losers. Okay, another example. So I told you a little bit of a random sampling of ideas on randomness. So let me give you another example in which randomness can lead to processes and objects of remarkable beauty. So let's talk about fractals. A fractal, bottom line definition of a fractal is an object that is self-similar. So let's look at the construction of a deterministic fractal, first of all. So this is called the Koch curve or snowflake. You start with a triangle. Let's say that each one of these has a length of 1. So on this, on the sides of this triangle, I stick 3 little triangles, each of side length 1/3. Right? So from here to here, I just popped on 3 triangles. Then, for the next one down here, I do the same thing. I cut this length into a third and pop those little triangles on every one of those line segments. And I do the same thing again, and I do it again, and I do it again, and I do it again. On a computer, I can do it essentially an infinite number of times. I run out of resolution. Incredible mathematical properties of this kind of thing. One of them is that you can draw a circle around it, or you can put it in a square. In other words, its area is bounded, but its perimeter is infinite. Okay? So clearly it's an object that only a mathematician could really love, but you can nevertheless create it out of mathematical rules. The Mandelbrot set, famous for a lot of work on fractals, including deriving coining the word fractal, is a more sophisticated example of that, let's say. It's iterated complex equations that give you beautiful structures that do not run out of complexity as you go down. So this is starting with the big picture, then you take one little piece of this, I think it's over here, magnify it, take one little piece of that, magnify it some more, and you can see, you can magnify this all you want, and you're never going to run out of complexity. You're never going to reach a point where there's nothing interesting to see. There's no next level. That's a great example of a fractal, because you keep going up in levels of magnification, down in levels of detail, you still pick up more stuff, more variability. Okay, those are deterministic fractals. Let's look at a couple of examples of where random fractality might be useful. This is a very famous paper by Mandelbrot. How long is the coast of Britain? Well, this is based on the idea that if you take you could do this at home, literally take a map, get out your atlas if you still have one, or Google Maps, I guess, can do this for you. Get a fairly large map of a coastline. Not all coastlines follow this, by the way, but most of them do, many of them do. And decide to measure the length of that coastline with a ruler of a certain length. And you can move that ruler along the coastline and you get a length. Well, let's say you want to double check that answer. You do it with a ruler of half the size. Well, now you pick up little details that you didn't get the first time. Then you make the ruler smaller, and you continue to make the ruler smaller and smaller and smaller. And what happens? The apparent length of the coastline increases every time you make the ruler smaller, because you're picking up little bits and pieces that you couldn't pick up before. So where do you end? What's the length of the coastline? Well, turns out it's an ill-posed question. And one way to address this, and this is really the insight Mandelbrot has, is to treat it as a scaling law. So just recognize the fact that as the scale length increases, the apparent length, so this is read it from right to left, as scale length changes, the apparent length increases. If you plot this on a log-log scale, logarithm of both values, you get straight lines, which means it is a power law, not an exponential. And if you look at the slope of that line, you can report the slope of that line as a fractal dimension, a fractal scaling exponent. And it turns out that value, more than the length per se, is the better way to quantify something like a coastline. Doesn't help you if you have to walk from one end of England to the other, but it's more mathematically insightful. Okay, so this kind of idea has been used over and over for computer generation of scenery. Here's an example of how you can do it to generate mountain landscapes. It's been used to characterize fractal structures, even in the body, forests, trees, limb structures. The branching patterns of lungs, you see it over here, looks a lot like a fractal. Now, clearly, a biological fractal like this, you are going to run out of variability at one end or the other. At the large end, there's the size of the lung. At the small end, you stop the branching. Nevertheless, many of these systems, objects, and processes show this kind of mathematical scaling over several orders of magnitude. So there's something going on here that turns out to be a useful, depicting them as fractals turns out to be useful and an accurate depiction. Okay, let me skip that one. So those are some ideas about how randomness may bring about beauty. Random structure can lead to things, or random processes can lead to things with remarkably intricate structure that look as if they have been designed, even though they've been brought about by a random system. So let me talk about a couple of other, say, good things brought about by randomness. So, some examples from astronomy. Karl Jansky, looking for the source of shortwave interference. This is back in the 1920s, worked in Bell Labs, trying to establish transatlantic radio telephone communication, and Bell Labs said, what's all this static? Where does all the static come from? So Jansky made a big antenna that he could rotate and point in different places, as he found out that one of the sources of noise is galactic. It's coming from stars, nebula, stuff out there in space. So he's looking at noise, he's looking for the source of a random process, and he just happens to stumble upon radio astronomy. A few decades later, Penzias and Wilson in the 60s, looking for the source of cosmic background, that's what they found, looking for the sources of interference, again at Bell Labs, so they're all about communication, looking for sources of interference in microwave communication. So they're looking at a much higher frequency range. They stumble upon the cosmic background radiation, the echo of the Big Bang. Okay, all brought about because people are trying to track down sources of apparently random behavior. Now, in these cases, maybe it is random. We might be able to say that these really are random processes that they're trying to track down, or maybe they're just the source of so many individual, or the result of so many individual sources, they just appear random to us. Nevertheless, chasing down randomness led to great insights in these cases. Einstein, one of his classic papers in 1905 on Brownian motion, trying to figure out what is the motion of these little particles in a fluid that are just bouncing around back and forth. Well, he worked out the equations, and it so happened that, gee, if water and other fluids are made up of molecules of just the right size impinging randomly on an object suspended in that fluid, it's going to exhibit something that looks a lot like Brownian motion. So, one of the first definitive proofs of the atomic structure of matter. I remember in the early 1900s, this was not completely accepted that matter was made of atoms. So a major contribution to that, again, through looking for randomness. So let's look at some other ways in which randomness can be brought to our use, how we can marshal it for our purposes. Something called Monte Carlo simulation. You have an incredibly complex system that you need to simulate on a computer. You can't possibly go through every possible combination of parameters and variables and conditions. Well, you do a random sampling of it. And so this is what I'm going to show you here is a very, very trivial example, but a very clever and overblown way to calculate the area of a circle that'll give you a bit of a flavor of Monte Carlo simulation. Let's say you want to figure out the area of this circle. Well, embedded in a square, one by one, you know the area of this square. Fill this square, you probably can't see, but this is filled with random dots. So get a random number generator or radioactive decay, whatever. Start filling this square randomly with little particles and then count the proportion of those particles, the fraction of them, that land within the circle. Well, since the square has an area of one, the proportion of the particles that land within the circle give you the area of the circle. They tell you what fraction of the area of the square is existing in the circle. So that's, again, a trivial example, but it gives you an idea of how you can use computer simulations based on random processes to actually solve a problem. Another example, which I think is possibly very pertinent to the biological question, something called genetic algorithms, modeled upon evolution. This is a way to get at the optimization of a multivariate system, something that has 10, 20, 30 variables in it. The solution space is just too big to do an exhaustive search. Gradient descent probably isn't going to work. Might have a lot of local minima in the solution space. So how do you do this? Well, generate some population of candidate solutions. They don't even have to be very good. You can generate those completely randomly. So this is from a paper I wrote, coincidentally enough. And so in this case, I actually generate 100. So there's some actual values on here. So generate, let's say, 100 candidate solutions. Measure the fitness of each of those solutions. Each one of them, you're trying to solve a problem. You're trying to optimize something. So you have a way to measure how good your solutions are. So measure how good each one of those are, and then order those potential candidate solutions from the best one down to the lowest one. Then pick two at a time, but pick the ones near the top of the list preferentially. So pick them based on a probability distribution where you favor the ones that are better fits. But you don't ignore the long tail. Right? That's how you're able to explore the tails of the solution space, the distribution. So pick two of them and mate them. So you pick two vectors in this case. You take the top part of one of them and the bottom part of the other one, and you put them together. It's a very crude system. And then you use that, then you put that into your next population, and you do that for keep picking pairs of solutions, candidate solutions, until you've got the next generation of solutions, and then randomly pick one element of each one of those candidate solutions and randomly change it, imply a mutation, right? So the beauty of this is that it's a systematic way to explore large areas of the solution space and avoid the problem of getting trapped in a basin of attraction that takes you to a local minimum when there's a better solution over here. So this very naturally moves the solution around, and this is a very powerful technique. My last example, something called stochastic resonance. This is the counterintuitive effect that you get in physical systems, biological systems. It's been demonstrated very convincingly in biological systems. Adding just the right amount of noise to a system will actually improve its performance. And that's based on the fact that if you have a system that's worked, that's a threshold system, you have to, for example, you're trying to hear a tone in a noisy room, right? A very pure sine wave tone, which you could imagine would be this. And it never quite reaches the threshold of your hearing, but you add a little bit of static to that tone. You add a little bit of noise to it to raise it just enough so that some of the peaks of it hit your threshold of hearing. Well, your auditory system does the rest, fills in the gaps, and you can then hear that tone. It'll appear noisy to you. It'll sound noisy, but at least you'll be able to detect a pure tone, whereas if you took the noise off of that tone, you wouldn't be able to hear it at all. You've popped it above threshold just enough, periodically, so that you're then able to sense it. And it's called a resonance phenomenon, because if the noise is too small, it doesn't work at all. If the noise is too big, it's just noise. So the noise, like a resonant system, the noise has to be within a certain band. So a great example of how a random process may actually assist us. Okay, so I believe this is my next to last slide. And I had to throw this in because there's a lot of talk the last 2 days, Randy Isaac's talk among others, about information, various forms of information. So I felt compelled to point out that one of the prevailing definitions of information, Shannon information or Shannon entropy, is based on uncertainty, is a probabilistic definition. And here's the basis of how it works. If I'm sending you a message and I only have one symbol to choose from, A, you know I'm going to send you A every time. There's no information there. There's no surprise. If I have a population that consists of A or B and I get to choose them independently from one trial to the next, well, now I have two pieces of information. I've doubled the amount of information. The larger I make that population, the more uncertain you are about what symbol I'm going to send, the more information is in each one of those symbols. So that's a little bit counterintuitive, because as the entropy of my system goes up, as the probability that I'm dealing with, as the distribution increases, the entropy increases of what I have to choose from, the information actually increases. Now, as Randy yesterday was careful to point out, Shannon is very clear to say this has nothing to do with the semantic content, with the meaning of the message. This just has to do with the amount of information in this restricted sense conveyed by the message. Nevertheless, it's another example of how probabilistic and random descriptions can help us get some insights into real-world problems and issues. So let me conclude with a couple of points. Randomness is a law just as fundamental to how the universe works as any physical mathematical law we know. Randomness is not haphazard. Follows rules. Math and physical laws demonstrate possibly divinely ordained universal order. Despite our subjective sense, our perceptions, our limited perceptions, randomness as a beauty and order of its own may be embraced as one of God's organizing principles. Now, I got to say that on the other hand, I may be completely full of it. It is certainly true that it is certainly possible that everything, what I said at the beginning of the talk, everything we perceive of as random really is deterministic. We're just too limited in our sensory abilities, our information processing capacity, to see that. So, in fact, everything that looks random may be just piecewise controlled by God. But what would be the point of that? What would be the point of leading us on, giving us the sense of beauty and structure and order inherent in studying randomness, if, in fact, that's not really what's going on at all? It's a philosophical question, but nevertheless, we have to admit that that may, in fact, be the answer. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Questions? Mark.
Thanks for the talk. So randomness is can be related to the idea of openness of a system, which can be related to a philosophical thing called free will. What would you have to say about the role that randomness may or may not play in the openness of systems in that context?
Yeah, I wish I had given that some thought before I got here. It's a great question, but I think it has to, if anything, it may have to do with my final point. It's, you know, people can say that I really have no free will, but I can decide to walk off the end of the stage here anytime I want. Now that may be just a random thought that enters my mind, or is it? I don't know. The thing is, I don't know if we will ever know because of the limitations in what we're able to comprehend. You know, randomness and dynamical systems, as we're finding out, even deterministic ones, are incredibly complicated. So it almost comes down to a philosophical question, which means it's my way of saying that I really don't know.
One more question.
So right at the beginning when you were mentioning the Kalman filter, are you saying that engineers do or do not use randomness when they use that Kalman filter?
Yeah, it's more of a pragmatic decision on their part. I think they recognize that there may be some processes out there that are just, I might as well treat that. There may be some deterministic component, but I might as well treat it as a random system because there's no way that I'm going to get to the bottom of it. It's inconsequential to what else I'm trying to do. If you're trying to do ship navigation, wave structure, now there are people who study waves, probably chaotic systems. So you could probably extract some information out of wave structure and use that to improve your estimate. On the other hand, you can just say, all right, I know the distribution of the wave heights and the frequency distribution, blah, blah, blah. I can build that into a random system, put that into my Kalman filter. That's good enough. And I think that's the kind of thing that Kalman was railing against by saying, don't be lazy and just use a random formulation when, in fact, you could learn something by going and really exploring it. On the other hand, ship navigator designer is not necessarily an oceanographer, so you can't do everything.
Thank you again, Mark. We're going to go ahead and proceed with the beverages and come back in about 10, 15 minutes and proceed with the rest of the talk. Thank you. Yes, 3:15. Sorry. Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, we have poster sessions. I'm sorry. So beverages and then posters, please feel free to look at those, and we'll come back at 3:15. Thank you.